Welcome to the West Elk Word. I'm Tony Todd, here today with Dr. Daniel Blumstein. Dr. Blumstein is a professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at UCLA. He has led the Marmot Project at Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory since 2001, but was involved with it for a number of years prior to that.
Kind of like Groundhog Day. I come back here every year.
Every year. Well, welcome to the West Elk Word. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with something that may seem like a simple question, but it's really not that simple. What is a marmot?
Marmots are charismatic mesofauna, as I like to describe them. Marmots are ground squirrels. There's 15 species of them. They live around the northern hemisphere, but they're closely related to ground squirrels and prairie dogs.
So Punxsutawney Phil and your average Gunnison prairie dog, those are marmots to a certain degree. Yeah.
Prairie dogs are not marmots, but groundhogs, Punxsutawney Phil, is a marmot.
Okay. Tell us about the history of this research project. I know you go back at least 24 years as the head guy, but you have predecessors. Tell us about that and why that matters.
So Ken Armitage, a professor at the University of Kansas, came out and started studying marmots here in 1962. And he would individually mark them and follow them throughout their lives. This is the second longest study of individually marked mammals in the world. And, you know, that sounds great. I mean, so Jane Goodall started studying chimpanzees in Gambia and Tanzania in 1960. And, you know, okay, great. These are long-term studies. But long-term studies are really valuable, particularly when you sort of think and realize that most studies of things in the wild last a couple of years, the amount of time it takes someone working on their PhD or master's thesis to sort of go out and collect data. So, you know, we're in our 64th year, and a 64-year long study gives you all sorts of insights into how things change over time and how they may be sensitive to environmental variation. Some of these questions are kind of important these days in a very changing environment.
Well, and one of the things you can actually study is the adaptability of the animal over a long period of time. And I know you're looking at the concept of adversity, or what maybe in the study of humans, it would be the study of childhood trauma and its impact on kids when they grow up. And you're doing a similar study now with the marmots. Is that right?
Yeah, my student, Sochil Ortiz Ross, and I have realized that all of these things that we might view as cumulative adversity in humans also may occur to animals. Typically, people look at one thing at a time when they're thinking about animals, but they've developed adversity indices for humans. So a couple people looked at this in some primate species, but we sort of said, let's take a step back and think about how one could generally use marmots as a system to understand how to develop an adversity index for wildlife. So for example, if the snow melts out late the year you're born, that's not so good for you. You have less time to gain mass. If your mother dies, it turns out that's not so good for you if in your first year of life. If you're in a big litter, it's not so good for you. If your mother is stressed out, it's not so good for you. And so with, you know, a lot of years of data, we know what's good and what's not good, you know, for marmots. And then we said, well, let's figure out how to sort of add these up. And what's really interesting is that in the human literature, you know, you can watch your mother being killed by your father, which is really bad. And this leads to all sorts of, you know, later health issues and shorter lives. But you could also then be adopted by people who love you and care for you. Turns out that love and care doesn't reverse the trauma. So we came up and evaluated different ways of looking at summing bad things that marmots experience. And we sort of said, well, if you're sort of at an extreme end of a distribution, snowmelt date, if the snow melts out in June rather than April, it's bad if it melts out in June, usually melts out in May. So we said, okay, well, let's just say if you're at the extreme end, we're going to give that a one. And if you're not, we're going to call that zero. And then we did this for a series of things over the first year or even first 2 years of an animal's life. And then we also said, well, relatively, so that gives you a number, zero to, I think, nine in the first year and zero to 14 in the second, first 2 years. And then we said, okay, well, instead of viewing that as sort of a binary one or zero, let's sort of look at it as a relative number. You know, what is that snowmelt date? How does that standardize out? And the idea here was that maybe, you know, being born in a really good year, meaning that there's a lot of time to gain mass, snow melted out in April like this year, that would be really good. And that would reduce the effects of other adversities. Turns out, just like humans, you know, marmots, a binary index, a summing of the bad things, but not an erasing by having good things happen to you, seems to be associated with longevity and lifetime reproductive success and other sorts of things. So just like humans, cumulative adversity can really take a toll on animals. Why is this interesting? Because often when we're thinking about how to manage populations, maybe threatened populations, endangered populations, things, we focus on something that we know is very bad, but we don't consider all of these things. And what this suggests is that maybe an alternative strategy, instead of focusing on one thing, and maybe you don't have control over one thing, snow melt date, you don't have much control over that. But maybe instead of focusing on one thing that we know is very bad, we can reduce that cumulative burden. We can reduce human impacts on animals. We can do other things that we have control over. We can supplementally feed them potentially. And that will reduce that cumulative burden, the total burden of bad things. And that may be really good for longevity and reproductive success. So, you know, we're doing more studies in this realm, but I think it's a new way of thinking about how we manage wildlife.
I think that's interesting because those are some of the things we do for people, especially people whose trauma is related to natural disasters or war.
Yeah. And unfortunately, some of that trauma is going to stick. And that's really sad. We can try to erase things. Head Start programs work. Some things can't necessarily be erased.
Are there some lessons that you've learned in the study of marmots with regard to adaptability and resilience that apply to people that you can extrapolate some lessons?
Well, yes and no. I wrote a book called The Nature of Fear, and I think about anti-predator behavior, and marmots feature prominently in the book, as do many other species I study and other people have studied. And I think there are lessons from that. You can get the book at the visitor center or, you know, on Amazon. When we think about global heating, these have been some of the hottest years we've had for, you know, at least 62 years, at least the first 60 years of this study, we pretty much worked in the morning and the afternoon. The past couple of years, we haven't been able to work in the afternoon. It's too hot. And we don't want to hurt the animals. If we catch an animal and it's too long in a trap in the sun, it can die. So we just don't trap. And they're not that active because it's just too hot for them. So we know this is happening. And, you know, we know that the environment is changing, and you can see it here with the moisture in the snowpack being heavier and leading to really big spring avalanches and things like that. So the question is, how do populations respond? So they can respond by being flexible within a generation. In my game, we call that phenotypic plasticity. A trait that you might have can change as a function of the environment. And the environment could be temperature, snowmelt, other sorts of things.
Can that happen in a short period of time?
Yeah, this is within generational change.
Okay.
So, you know, it means that if you're at a quiet party, you're going to talk quietly. If you're at a loud party, you're going to talk louder, right? So that's plasticity. So the other, and that's one way to respond to things, being plastic. There might be limits to that, but that's plasticity. The other way to respond is evolutionarily. And what that means and what that requires is some genetic variation. So lots of people go out and, you know, a lot of biomedical studies look for, you know, the gene associated with something. And that's great. But most genes don't have big effects alone. And really, it's suites of genes being expressed in an environment that explain things. I'm rolling my tongue here. If you can tongue roll, we know that trait is explained by a single gene. If you can't roll your tongue, then you don't, you know, you have one particular type of that gene. If you can roll your tongue, you have another type. But most traits aren't like that. So there's a whole field of quantitative genetics, and it really is used in animal breeding and plant breeding. And, you know, the idea is that if there's genetic variation in a population, you can select for that population to change. When we think about breeding poodles, or all these dog breeds we have, let's make that poodle smaller. We're going to select the smallest poodles from a population, and they're going to be the ones who breed. Let's make, you know, that sheep bigger. Let's, you know, we're going to select the biggest set of those individuals, and we're going to breed those. And over time, if there's genetic variation, the population will change. So what we've been doing is a lot of quantitative genetics. And what quantitative genetics allows you to do is estimate both, in a very specific way, the environmental variation and the genetic variation. And while both of those may vary for different traits, pretty much every trait we've looked at, mass gain, how you sound, how fast you run, all sorts of traits, immunological responses, all sorts of traits, we're finding good evidence that there is both phenotypic and genetic variation there. And that sort of says that yellow-bellied marmots, not all species, but yellow-bellied marmots have the types of plasticity that allow them to respond within their lifetimes and then potentially evolve.
What sorts of traits are they evolving? As opposed to immediate traits and behavioral changes, what sorts of evolutionary traits are you seeing that are changing?
So we're not necessarily, we might be seeing some body mass things, but most of the changes we're seeing that variation persist. In other words, there is genetic variation. And I'm really having a hard time getting federal funding for my research.
Oh, I bet.
And we put in three proposals looking at why are we seeing selection? Because some individuals survive based on their genes and some don't, but we're not seeing evolution, meaning we're still seeing this genetic variation persist, which is, I think, a really interesting question. And my colleague, Julian Martin, thinks is a really interesting question. After three tries, this panel, which funds long-term research, says, don't come back to us again. We're never going to fund you. You have too much data. I mean, I don't even know what that means. We, you know, argued that actually part of that solution could be what's called shifting, you know, selection. In what, if you know, if you live in this area and are here in the spring, some years it melts out early, some years it doesn't. That actually selects for different responses in the marmots. So if you have that environmental variation, that can maintain genetic variation. It also seems to be true, and we're beginning to explore this, but we don't have enough data for many of the traits we're looking at, that there's selection on different age animals to have different traits. And there could be differential selection on different sexes. But in order to look at a whole bunch, and there could be differential selection on different traits that are genetically correlated. So in any event, we need a lot more data to really tease these things apart, but that's what we're trying to do in the near future.
If you are just joining us here today on the West Elk Word, I'm Tony Todd, here today with Dr. Dan Blumstein, head of the Marmot Research Program at Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory. One of the studies I know you've been working on is with regard to female marmots and reproduction, and the idea that the female marmots who are very kind and social and supportive of other female marmots tend to produce fewer or smaller litters, or sometimes not produce litters at all. Why is that? Do you have an idea?
Well, I mean, years ago, I was actually with this group of people trying to think about how we take lessons from life and apply them to security and defense. And this is post 9/11, and I'm reading about all these terrorist networks. And I'm like, these statistics that people are using to think about the structure of terrorist networks, why don't we do this for animals? So with the marmots, we were one of the first groups to really go and do a lot of studies. And we've been doing it for well over a decade now, of looking at social networks in marmots. So the same way, you know, you've got friends and friends of friends and things like that, and you could be central in your group or not central in your group. You could be central in one sort of group in one sort of context, but not another sort of group or another sort of context. We've been asking all these questions with marmots. And the initial take-home messages were that being too social isn't good for you. If you're a female, you're less likely to breed and have smaller litters. If you're too nice and connected, and for all animals, you're less likely to survive the winter if you're too nice, which is kind of interesting. We have also been looking more recently at the structure of the group itself. Some groups, like some businesses, have more efficient structures than others. Do these have consequences? And the answer seems to be, yeah, they do. And recently, my former student, Connor Filson, showed that the structure of the group and the selection of the structure in the group can be more important than individual relationships and connections to others. Why is that important? Because at some level, this is thinking about something, a very controversial topic called group selection. And the idea is that people have poo-pooed group selection because evolution acts on individuals and their genes. And groups have lots of individuals and genes. But if you find yourself in a well-functioning group, that may be good for your genes as well. We've shown that the strength of selection can be even stronger for being in the right group structure than your individual relationships with others, which is kind of cool.
Could it be because of your genes that you've selected a well-functioning group?
It could be.
Some sort of a draw?
Yeah, so the causality on these is difficult. We observe marmot social interactions. We don't make them. We observe the groups. We don't make the groups, et cetera. But we also know, years ago, we asked the question, you know, is there heritable variation in social network position? And we said, well, if there's going to be, we predicted that it would be for things I can do to you. In other words, and probably nice things, because nice things you have control over. If you get in a fight, maybe you're in a fight and you don't have a lot of control over that. So we look at affiliative behaviors, and we look at agonistic or nasty behaviors, and we made the predictions that, you know, that if there's going to be heritable variation, it's going to be in nice things, and particularly nice things, you know, I do to you rather than you do to me, because I have control over that. The answer was exactly opposite of what we expected, which was that basically we have heritable victimization in marmots. What was heritable was not me doing something to you, but you beating me up and me tolerating it. And it's like, what does that mean? You know, well, what it means is there's only one dominant animal in a group, and anyone else that wants to live in a group, they may receive some benefits by being in that group. They're going to have to tolerate aggression to some extent. And we know that animals disperse. They leave their groups. So there's probably been selection to maintain that heritable variation in receiving aggression from others, which is kind of interesting. Now, is there a gene for that? No. I mean, these are relationships, but there are genes that almost certainly influence how you tolerate interacting with others. And this suggests that those have consequences and can be quantified in terms of looking at animals coming or going, or how they interact with others, and what sort of social networks they form.
Wow, that's amazing.
The other thing is that we know that, and these marmot results are really interesting, because if you think about humans, being socially isolated is not good for your health, and it's not good for your longevity. And in fact, it's sort of about as bad as smoking, you know, one or two packs of cigarettes a day, mm-hmm. in terms of decreasing your health and longevity. But these marmots, other marmots are more social, but yellow-bellied marmots are what we call facultatively social. They don't have to interact with others. They can do it alone, and they vary quite a bit. And that makes them a really good system to study the benefits and costs of being social. More obligately social species, many primate species, humans, et cetera, people typically find benefits from being social, and we're finding lots of costs. The few benefits we're finding typically are pretty small, and often they're very contingent. So I think a lesson from a lot of years of data that you don't get from a couple, you know, years of study, is that there are many things that happen in life. They may change over time. The benefits of them may change over time and location. And that many of the things we're looking at have relatively small, but they could be consequential effects. And I think that's sort of a truism.
I know one of the studies that you were engaged in, I don't know if you're still doing this, but you were making observations on early snowmelt versus later snowmelt, how long they hibernate. You were making some observations on the possible genetic link.
Yep, there is some heritable variation associated with hibernation length. The question is, why does that still exist? You know, shouldn't it have been selected away? And I think that, you know, again, this shifting environment keeps that genetic variation present. 3 years ago here, I could barely get into my cabin when I skied out in April. This year, I could dig out a water line and turn it on in April on the day we skied out, which was extraordinary. You know, there wasn't a lot of snow this year, and there was a lot of snow 3 winters ago. Who knows what next year is going to be? So I think that this variation begets or maintains genetic variation to some degree. But having genetic variation allows there to be evolutionary responses. Now, these growing seasons vary quite a bit. And long growing seasons often are good for marmots because they have more time to gain weight before they hibernate. And that means for the young, they have a higher chance of surviving. Our babies that have been emerging this year, and there are a lot of them, are almost a kilo now, which is great. They'll gain another, 500 or so, 600 or so grams, and they'll probably survive very well over the winter, unless it's a really long spring. But the mothers who bred, reproduced a little earlier, are going to have more time to gain mass as well, and that's good for them. However, every day you're out, the foxes and coyotes and badgers have another day to kill you.
That's what I was just going to ask. Have you studied predation in relationship to this?
And the question is, a lot of people think about environmental mismatches. The flowers bloom, but the pollinators aren't there because the pollinators are running on one clock and the flowers are running on this environmental clock. And we don't necessarily see those sorts of mismatches with the marmots. There's always something for them to eat, or there's nothing for them to eat if there's a lot of snow. But what we do see is we see for some ages, this work isn't published yet, and I forget the exact detail, but I think it's for yearlings, it doesn't really matter. But for older animals, there's an optimal duration of an active season. And if it's too long, it's not as good as if it's just right. So, but the slope on that is kind of shallow. So again, small effects, but there seems to be something there.
The longer that lush season is, the better the chances of their luck running out in terms of
exactly
getting grabbed. Yeah,
exactly. And predation is the main source of summer mortality, except for cars and outhouses and people and things like that.
Outhouses. Do they fall into them? Is that the deal?
Unfortunately, there are a couple of outhouses that have killed some marmots in Gothic, and we try to seal those up, but every once in a while we find another marmot in them.
What a way to go. That's
horrible. I've built little ladders for them to climb out, and they've climbed out. I pulled them out and hosed them off before, but sometimes we just actually the guy pumping the outhouses finds them.
Wow. Dan, what is it about marmots that's kept you fascinated all these years?
They have an address, so you know where to find them. They more or less conform to some academic calendars, meaning they hibernate about 7 months a year, so you don't have to be here. Studying primates is really hard because you always got to be there. You know, that doesn't really work well with the day job we all have. They live in beautiful places. So I've studied 8 of the 15 species of marmots all around the Northern Hemisphere. I've been really lucky and privileged to do that, and I've learned a lot. But for the last, decades, I've been here. This is, we're coming into a centenary campaign for our centenary anniversary of the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory. And, we're a place of long-term studies. We probably house more long-term studies than any other place on Earth. We're individual plants. David Inouye has been studying individual plants for over 50 years, or plots of plants, for over 50 years, and looking at change. People have been censusing stream invertebrates and bees and things like that, and asking all sorts of contemporary questions, but also amassing large data sets. So being in a place with this sort of intellectual history and this excitement about long-term studies and support for long-term studies is fabulous.
And a great deal of this research has huge implications for humanity.
I would think so. I ask questions about marmots. I use marmots as a model system to understand bigger questions. How does adversity affect wildlife? What does this mean, et cetera? Are there optimal times to, be active if you're a hibernating animal? But pollination biology is everything. We now have people studying hydrology up here, and we have for decades. And I mean, this is the headwaters of the Colorado River. I live in LA the rest of the year. Some of my neighbor's water comes from here. My neighborhood doesn't get water from here. We steal ours from the Owens Valley. But in any event, what happens here doesn't stay here. And understanding the biophysical processes occurring here, it's never been more important to study that.
Anything else you'd like folks to know about marmots and your current research?
It's hard to get funding for this stuff, and it's not getting any easier right now. We're getting pretty genomic right now. We're really looking at adversity, and we just got a grant funded from something called the Wild Animal Initiative, which really thinks about wild animal welfare, and we want to know how adversity has leads to genetic changes. Now, when we talked about genetic changes before, I was talking about genes, but there's other sorts of changes to your genome that you can have as well. And this is called methylation. So these are within generational changes to your genes. And basically, regulatory genes can be gunked up if animals get stressed out or we get stressed out. And this leads to changes in how they're expressed. These epigenetic changes can also be used to age animals. So we know that in humans, you have a chronological age, you've been alive a certain number of days, and then you can calculate your epigenetic age. So this is a way of looking at accelerated or decelerated aging. So we've done this with marmots. We have an epigenetic clock for marmots. And now the next question we're going to be asking is, how does adversity lead to, does it lead to more epigenetic changes? Does it lead to an accelerated aging, in these wild populations? And people do kind of things like this in laboratory situations, but laboratory situations are all controlled, and animals have many ways of, responding. And do we see this in nature? So this will be one of the first studies looking at this in this way in nature.
This is fascinating to me because it can help predict how and why we are the way we are in the future, but it can also explain how and why we are the way we are today.
And are there compensatory mechanisms? Are there ways to compensate for past experiences? And how might those play out? And maybe you can compensate for some, but not others. So that's sort of a whole realm of kind of what we're trying to get at with marmots, which is a wild animal, living in nature, which has implications, well, for us and how we think about us, but also how we think about wild populations. And Wild Animal Initiative is excited about this because they're really interested in creating a field of wild animal welfare. What things are good for animals and what things are bad for animals, what things reduce their quality of lives, what things might be associated with enhanced quality of life.
Well, I think we could talk about this stuff all day. This is fascinating, even though most of it's really pretty much over my head since I'm not a scientist, but I'm really finding it very interesting. Thank you so much for joining me today on the West Elk Word. I hope we can do this again sometime.
Thanks again.
Well, that's it for this edition of the West Elk Word. To hear past episodes, go to programs at kbut.org. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Support for KBUT and the West Elk Word comes from Towny Books and Rumors Coffee and Tea House, serving locally roasted coffee and fine loose leaf teas. Towny Books stocks new books for children and adults and can special order anything. Read books, drink coffee, fight evil.